It's time for To The Last Drop podcast with Liam Del Carm and Brendan Nell.
In today's show, we look at the Springbok team to play Argentina at Ellis Park on Saturday. We will look ahead to that test at Ellis Park, the final one for the Springboks in the Rugby Championship. We also have an interview with seasoned Argentine journalist Frankie Dedges, and we will end off today's show with a little chat around Malbec, that wonderful wine from the western part of Argentina that has provided so much pleasure to travelers to that part of the world.
Yeah, let's get right into it. Interesting team that Jacques picked. Nine survivors from Loftus-Versfeld and nine changes from Auckland. A team that, to me, at first glance, when I saw the two scrum caps in the back three, Cheslin and Kirtley, I thought, geez, and then I saw Marnie and Grant Williams, and I thought, geez, this is a team that's going to run the leather off Ellis Park on Saturday.
Yeah, certainly a couple of interesting selections. If you say nine changes, it always sounds like the coach is reaching for something, or maybe he's trying to admonish certain people. I don't think that's the case in this test. Obviously, it's that part of the build-up to Rugby World Cup where combinations will be tested. Certain players' battle readiness will be put to the test. And I think we're seeing that in this particular selection. If you make nine changes, it can be quite disruptive, as we've seen before, but of course there is method to the madness in that, you know, there are only now four tests left before the Rugby World Cup kicks off, and only two tests left before the Rugby World Cup team is announced.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing we've got to keep in mind. Is it's one of those things where you shouldn't read too much into it. I know Jacques was at great pains today at the press conference. We're recording this just after the team announcement. And, he made quite clear that they're trying to spread the load, in his word, where it's trying to get as many minutes across the entire squad. Of course, yeah, obviously there'll always be exceptions. There'll always be certain players who get a few more minutes than others. And I think what they've done is they've gone with a very strong pack. You see guys like Marnie Lebok and Grant Williams coming in, but there is a lot of experience around them. And I think that's one of the reasons why you see a Dwayne Vermeulen at eight, and not that he shouldn't be there anyway. I mean, he's got a good claim to the position anyway as captain. And Damien Delenda at 12. And I know a lot of people probably ask why not André Esthuizen. But I think Damien being there next to an inexperienced fly-off, is probably a very good thing at this moment.
Absolutely. I think the experience thing is important, especially when you sort of isolate the halfback situation where we have two inexperienced halfbacks in Grant Williams and Marnie Lebok. But then you sort of juxtapose that to what we have in the forward pack, and you look at the front row with combined caps there between Frans Malherbe, Malcolm Marx, and Stephen Kutsoff, where they tally almost 200. So, you know, there are certain positions that have been fortified. And, you know, in the back line, I suppose they will have to be at some point, the accent will have to be on a little bit of inexperience because you need to test players. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Yeah, the thing to me was, I mean, even when you look at that, it's an inexperienced center combination as well. Even though, I mean, Jesse Creel has got, 60-odd tests, and Damien's probably on this bit more than that. And, they haven't played together as a combination as much. But, there's another thing I thought, let me test this, Liam. I mean, there's a lot of people out there on Twitter and or whatever Twitter's called nowadays who seem to sort of question the selection of Jesse Creel. But I don't think people quite understand the reasons why he's selected. I mean, other than his versatility, he can play fullback, wing, and center. He's a great team man, and he's an exceptional defender at 13, which is probably the most difficult place to defend on the field.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I was playing golf earlier today, and even at the golf course, there were people wanting to discuss that number 13 jersey and Jesse's inclusion. And the simple fact is that the guy has a lot of experience in that position. He has served the Springboks well. As the coaches, I don't want to sound like one of the coaches, but it's one of those things that they always say. It's one of those cliched things where they say they know what they have in that particular player. He also comes with a lot of IP in terms of what he's done for the Springboks in that position. And you mentioned his versatility. You know, he's always going to be a useful player to have, you know, in a squad environment. And we've seen that in the past. I mean, he doesn't grab the headlines every time he plays, but he does tick most of those boxes.
Yeah, and I think something was maybe being misunderstood a lot of the time, but I hear a lot from fans as well who talk to me on social media as well about what about Andre Esthuizen? And I think there's a misconception there that Jesse's taking Esthuizen's place. And
no.
I think people must realize Andre Esthuizen is a 12, and that's his favorite position. Plus, yeah, he's not a guy who's overly experienced, and I think Damien Delenda has earned his right in that place. He's won a World Cup in the 12. There's no reason to drop him. But I think people sometimes get it wrong that they think Jesse's competing with Andre Esteves in that place, where and in fact he's competing with Damien Delenda. Sorry.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
yeah. Look, it comes back to when a Springbok team is named, you don't necessarily, or the coaches don't necessarily go for what is the sort of form 15 when it comes to the starting lineup. They always see a bigger picture and they will make their selections based around that. And obviously this is a World Cup year, so you will find situations where starting lineups are put together based on, you know, the journey forward. And I think we see it again in this particular squad. So, you know, those days of where the notion of the best potential or the best form 15 playing each test, I'm sorry, but those days are over.
Yeah, and plus, I mean, you've got to think of the World Cup. If you look at the last two World Cups, there were two injuries in the first two games. You know, we had to replace players. So, I mean, that's where the squad system comes in a lot more. And you want a squad of 30-odd players who can slot in, the perfect world is to have a squad that anybody can play at any time and you don't lose anything. And I think that's, I mean, coaches always strive for that. They don't always get it. But and you do have superstars. But, yeah, I think that's where the box are going. And if you look at the depth that they've created over the past few years, yeah, they've done pretty well. And I think people forget sometimes this is a coaching team that won a World Cup. Sort of earned the right to back their own decisions. And that's why, I mean, I'm sometimes the kind of, there's always banter around the Springbok squad, and there's always people who want their own favorite player in, and you can understand that. But I think the big question, I think when I saw that squad, the one question that jumped into my head was, you know, while it's extremely exciting and Ellis Park is a fast pitch, and if that backline gets going, we're going to see some amazing rugby. The one question that immediately comes to mind is, in terms of the two scrum caps on the wing, they're both not the tallest guys. I mean, not that I'm the tallest guy as well, or you, Liam. I mean, no offense, but
no.
Yeah, they. If I was Argentina, the first thing I would do is, and especially given the way the box handled the ball in Auckland and the high ball, I would kick bombs on them all day and see if you can get them. Luckily, they're two very brave players, so I'm not too concerned, but I think that would definitely be somewhere they target.
Yes, I think it's something we can expect, but it's also one of those things that if you were going to go into a World Cup, into a big tournament like that, you would want to test those players, you know, if there are question marks about a particular element of their game. It has to be put to the test somewhere, and if in this case it happens to be the Springboks' last home test, before they go to the World Cup, then so be it. But there will be great expectation from from people in the stands that the box do well and that they set sail for the World Cup, with a confidence boosting win under the belt. So, you know, whatever Argentina throws at them, they need to weather the storm and stand up to that challenge.
Yeah, I think just a side note as well, which interesting little thing, which I didn't even realize, but this is Jacques Nienaber's last home test. Last test on South African soil as a Springbok coach. And when you think where he's come from, and he spoke a bit about it when he said he started in 2004 with the national teams, 2011 with the Springbok team, where he was helping in Peter de Villiers' coaching team. It's a long journey, and it's weird if you think it's coming to an end on Saturday.
It is. It's kind of snuck up on us in some ways. He's had an interesting career with the box. If you look at the period since start of 2020 when he became coach, obviously a year was lost due to COVID. There was the Sealers against British and Irish Lions that happened to be successful in the end. He's actually had a decent record given the time that the Boks have lost. And it's one of those things that might be worth asking him, sort of before he disappears to Dublin, whether he feels that, you know, what he has done as head coach, whether people value it or value it in the way maybe, you know, was he basically, what I'm trying to say is, was he appreciated enough, as head coach of the Springboks? Because obviously he has a record that spans a number of years, you know, within the Bok setup, and it's only been the last 3 or so years that it's been as head coach. So I just get the sense sometimes that the people tend to question him and like question his credentials, I think it's unfortunate because he's earned these stripes.
Yeah, I think he has, and I think unfortunately he's come along as a package with Rossi in most of the places.
Yeah.
He's been. So a lot of people maybe see him as being in Rossi's shadow a bit. Where anybody who's worked with him will know that he's a lot more intense and a lot more detailed than that, and the players respect him. So yeah, I don't think that's really a question from anybody who's around the box. But you can understand some people outside still question that, and it's unfortunate. It's a strange one because, I think if any coach, you get your first test series and it's the weirdest, strangest British and Irish Lions tour ever. I don't think there's anybody, if I know people watching at home probably thought that way, but I mean, I can't remember if you were in the stadium there, Liam, in Cape Town. I was.
It was very eerie.
It was the strangest, weirdest feeling there. And you can feel for any coach who's gone through that. We hope to get him on the show at some point so that we can chat to him about that. But, he's earned his stripes, as you say.
You're with Liam Delcombe and Brendan Nell on the To The Last Drop podcast.
Our next guest is a good old mate of ours. We both spent several nights together and several rugby tours together across the world. I know I've spent a number of nights in a place like Dubai for the Dubai Sevens with him. He's Argentina's most well-known and handsomest.
Dorian, I think, is the word.
Dorian, yeah. Frankie Degas. So, yeah, here's our chat with him. Guys, we're joined now by, as he describes himself, the most handsome journalist in Argentina, Frankie Degas. Frankie, welcome. Welcome to our pod.
Yeah, I didn't say the most handsome. I just said a handsome journalist from Argentina. But, I take the credit.
we've seen a few others, Frankie, so we're saying you're the most handsome. So don't worry about that.
Thanks.
Well, so, we can talk again towards the end of the conversation and we could, revisit that statement. Anyway.
Frankie, obviously the Pumas are in Joburg this week. They had a wonderful win against Eddie Jones's Australia. How did that go down in Argentina, especially after that first week loss against the All Blacks?
Well, that was a definite change of wind. We were all quite... I wouldn't say surprised, but scared from what we had seen of the team against the All Blacks in the opening weekend. And then the travel involved was huge. They were like 26 hours on the air, just going from one place to the other. Air travel for Argentinians has become a nightmare. So I think they jumped on a charter flight with the All Blacks through Santiago, Chile, through Auckland, and then made it to Cuji, which is a bit of a second home to Los Pumas, and they just recovered very well, and they played very well. I think they had a good game. They had it won. They could have lost it. They won it in the end. They showed that they could play some rugby, and basically they showed also the resolve that they hadn't showed in Mendoza. So that is good to know that it is there. Michael Chico, the coach, is toying a bit with availabilities, with return from injuries, with players not having played for a number of months. The problem for Argentine rugby is that we're based in the Southern Hemisphere, but our players play in the Northern Hemisphere. You guys have sorted it out by playing in the Northern Hemisphere. So there are challenges involved, and there are very few games. So the two next games against the Springboks are going to be extremely important to have a clearer idea of who's in line to play, what they want to play, how they want to play it, and just give us clues on how much we're going to raise our hopes for the World Cup.
we got a real sense that Argentina really undercooked against the All Blacks, and it's obviously one of the teams you don't want to go in undercooked against. I mean, it's that's just not done. It did seem a remarkable transformation, though, especially when you consider the travel that you just explained, that they were able to sort of turn that around so quickly. What do you put that down to?
I think it's time as a team. For the second game, they had basically two full weeks together, which they hadn't had. They only flew into Mendoza on the Sunday, you know. Although they had some informal training sessions together, and players keep fit. It's not like it was. They just popped in for the first training session on the Monday, but they hadn't been training as a squad. They hadn't been training as a team, and say the scrum half, he hadn't played since January. The winger, the one that was going to play was injured. They brought someone else. They had players that were not playing in their original positions. It was tough. I mean, we should have seen it kind of coming, but the way that they were beaten in the first 20 minutes to show that they were not even there, and that was the sad part, or the tough part to understand. 2 weeks later, 2 weeks training, 2 weeks together, they enjoy their own companies, they enjoy being together, they work well as a squad, they got better. They said in Sydney after the game, they only flew to South Africa. I think they flew in on Sunday. So they didn't have to fly home to fly to South Africa, which is today flying to South Africa is very hard. There are no direct flights. It's really uncomfortable. So probably they made the sensible thing. Now it's just they're ready. They just need to get through jet lag, which is part and parcel of what you do at this day and age.
Frankie, I was going to say, I mean, just in terms of the bigger picture, I mean, we've obviously spoken a lot about the other side of the World Cup draw, you know, the top four teams in the world in the same side of the draw. Argentina on the other side, they must be looking at that World Cup draw and saying, well, look, if they get a couple of things going right, then it could be quite a good walk towards the semifinals for them, and then hopefully further.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, it's what. And that is something that the coaches stress. It's one game at a time, because if you don't win the first game, you go into a second game with a different scenario. You don't win the second game, it's the third and whatever. Yes, England, we don't know where England is at the moment. We really don't know. They should be a team that is maybe probably on par with us, or maybe a step ahead in their development. But if we have the good win on our sales, that first game in Marseille could be great. It's going to be an incredible first weekend in Marseille with England playing Argentina, and then the next day it's Scotland against the Springboks. So just from a fan's perspective, from an everything perspective, that's going to be incredible. But that first game is a bit like the first game in Japan, 2019. They didn't make it against France by half an inch, penalty kick, whatever. And then it just became harder and harder. I believe we should be able to beat Samoa, and we should be able to beat Japan. Japan lost against Samoa the other day. Now Japan is in the top 10. No, sorry, Samoa is in the top 10. Japan is 12th in the world. So we do have three top 10 sides in our pool.
Frankie, just obviously turning back to Joburg now. Yeah, I suppose after the win, there's going to be a bit of expectation there. But I mean, Argentina's record in Johannesburg hasn't been great, on the Highveld, in fact, hasn't been great over the last couple of years. It's a very fast
lifetime. The last lifetime.
Yeah. Do you see changing that?
I think we've only won there in 1965. I don't have the records in front of me, but Ellis Park is very important to Argentine rugby, in that it was where we beat the Junior Springboks in 1965, and that generated what came in the future, in the following years. But yeah, it's not a comfortable place. We've only beaten the Springboks in South Africa once, and that was in Durban. So it's not the venue; it's the opponent, I think.
If we look at Argentina's results over the last, I'd say, decade, but maybe a bit less. I mean, there's wins against South Africa a couple of times. There's even the draw against the Springboks. There are obviously wins over Australia. There are wins over the All Blacks. And there's no doubt that Argentina have taken giant strides over the last decade or so. How much do you attribute that to rugby championship inclusion and what that has done for rugby in Argentina?
110%. I mean, the only way you can beat these guys is if you play them regularly. We have played regularly. Second game in the rugby championship, 16-16 draw in Mendoza against the Springboks. Then I think it took a few years before we could beat Australia. Then we beat you guys in Durban. And eventually the All Blacks, which were the castle we could never take, they lost in 2020 and 2022. So if you don't play regularly against that kind of opposition, it's very hard to, in a one-off, beat them. And in fact, Argentine rugby, and it's the sad demise of Super Rugby for us and for you guys. You guys found an alternative way, which is working for you guys. And we'll know more after the World Cup if it generated a World Cup winning team or not. But we lost Super Rugby, and with that, the possibility of, again, have a normal season in that you play in the Southern Hemisphere and you compete against Southern Hemisphere teams. We're trying to still work it out. 2020 was different because players were mostly unattached, and it was a totally different thing. But now players are just leaving earlier and earlier to go to Europe. If you've got to chase your Puma dream, that's where you want to be. And that's where you're competing at a higher level that allows you then to come back to play against your regular opponents and at least have a real opportunity of beating them. Then it's on the day, it's the win, it's a kick, it's a ref, it's so many decisions. When Argentina beat the games Argentina won, they deservedly won. So it wasn't a flash in the pan or whatever. It's consistency, and that has been always an accolade for Argentine rugby. How do you take it from week to week to week to week?
Despite those obstacles, obviously you've produced results, solid results over the last while. Do you still find, though, that given the way world rugby is run and structured, that there's almost always a struggle for recognition, and also, you know, you've got the results that people take you seriously? I mean, do you find that there are still those hurdles to cross?
Yeah, but people can not take you seriously at their own peril. I'm sure the teams, they know they're playing against Argentina and they prepare to play against Argentina and they don't like playing against Argentina. So, I mean, at the end of the day, we can talk and write whatever we want, but it's not what Cheka or whoever is preparing a test match will read. I mean, they'd be looking at the stats, they'd be looking at the opposition stats, they'd be looking at a different set of information that doesn't take into account if we played them 13 times and lost 5 or if whatever. So at the end of the day, recognition, peers recognize the Argentine players, peer coaches recognize Argentina as a team they don't enjoy playing.
Frankly, I want to turn to something else. On this pod, we obviously speak a lot of rugby, but the other thing we speak about is wine. And knowing you are men like us, you like to put some red meat on a fire, and just like most Argentinians and South Africans. And I'm sure you have a favorite Malbec. Do you tell us what would your favorite wine be, and what should South Africans look out for?
I'm so sorry, mate, that I can't help you on that one. I'm a teetotaler, and I've always been. I don't have a sad story of alcoholism or being beat up by my father when he was drunk or whatever, and that's why I don't drink. I've never drunk. I've never liked alcohol, and it's a sad part of my story, my life story. I just don't drink. I've never drank, and I don't enjoy it. My wife might be of some help, but she drinks for both of us. I connect a very good drunk, but I don't drink.
Oh dear.
In that case, tell us about the steak that we come across fairly often in Argentina, the bife de chorizo, I think it is.
Bife chorizo.
Bife Bife Chorizo. Is that the sort of best known cut in Argentina?
Yeah, I like when I put it on the parrilla, on our barbecue. I like the sirloin, the lomo.
Okay,
because that gets that's always tasty. But I mean, it's like soccer. Different people have different cuts, and they die for that cut. And I mean, I had a barbecue yesterday, as you do on, but it's my first Sunday barbecue because of rugby. My kids still play on Sundays. But so they had the weekend. Also, we had a big barbecue with some friends, and then we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different cuts of meat. So you just go through the whole set, and you might like this one a bit more. So give me 2 pieces of that or whatever. But what's most important of our asado, and it's with your bride, it's a whole ceremony of it. It's sitting down with mates, setting the fire on, just throwing stuff. It takes time. We don't do it quickly. It might take a couple of hours from the moment you light your match till you sit down and have lunch. And that whole process, you don't do it alone. People start coming in. They bring some cheese. They bring some charcuterie or whatever. And they start with the wine. I go with the water, unfortunately. And it's just conversation and fun and sorting life out in a philosophical way.
No, oh, absolutely. I mean, that's how we build bridges and build friendships, I suppose. I mean, it's
what I always say. It's what I always say. We talk about every one of the world's problems, and we solve no one. But we go through every problem.
We've done that a couple of times. I must admit, I can't wait to get to see you guys again, Frankie, and yeah, then hopefully we'll share a piece of meat somewhere. But hopefully it should be sooner rather than later.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure, mate, and you know my phone is open whenever you need.
No, cool. I'm good for them. I think let's just say thanks to Frankie for his time, and go Pumas, not this weekend, but at the World Cup.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frankie. And hopefully I'll see you in Provence.
That would be extremely nice to see you here, there, over there, wherever. But it's always good fun.
Liam, the one thing, I think one big regret in my life is I've never been to Argentina. I somehow missed every single rugby tour to Argentina, and it ended up mostly in Australia, New Zealand, and Europe. But for some reason, always, I've been to Brazil for holidays, but I've got to get to Argentina. And the one reason why, of course, is because there's that wonderful, wonderful vintage of theirs called Malbec. And now we're obviously not talking about Afrikaans people who maybe had a few too many. Talking about the red wine Malbec.
I know what you mean. Yeah, look, it's one of the absolute beauties of touring Argentina, because like us, apart from the love of rugby, they also like a good red meat or a good steak, and they like the red one. In their case, it's Malbec is very much the one they go for. And I've been fortunate enough to go to Malbec, a country which is very much in the west of Argentina, on the slopes of the foothills of the Andes in Mendoza, with the Springboks. I think the first rugby championship game against Argentina was away game, that is, was in Mendoza. So, yeah, spent a week there, ate steak, I think, 4 times that week, and consumed the local product. So
it
truly is an experience, and it's one that rugby fans who love a bit of food and drink, that they should experience.
So let's quickly touch on Malbec. What makes it different to other wines?
In some ways, it's like it's got like it's plump and it's fruity and it's a little bit smoky. Now you'll probably say that other wines have those characteristics as well, but then Malbec isn't necessarily for everyone. It's one of those grapes that it's susceptible to pests and it's susceptible to bad weather. So you can only grow it in certain regions, and Argentina is very fertile or provides fertile soil for that. I think 75% of the world's Malbec is grown in Argentina. The USA, I think, yields the second most, and South Africa only the third most. So it's not readily available. I mean, there are some decent South African Malbecs, But you'd also go into a wine shop where people tell you, no, they don't have Malbec because unless it comes from Argentina, they're not interested, which is probably not the right attitude to have. But I've certainly had some decent local Malbecs.
Yeah, I think, and we've got to be honest here. Normally we'd be enjoying a glass of wine here. Yeah, and we on the Frankie's teetotaler thing here at the moment because I don't think any of us could find a good Malbec as such. And we searched. So this is going to be our teetotaler edition. So hopefully not the first of many and hopefully the last one for a very long time.
I absolutely agree with you. We should really pull up our socks.
I suppose we almost like the box under that high ball at the moment. We deserve to have a reflection and to really look inward and enjoy some wine and just make sure that we're back on track at some point again.
Absolutely. Malbec apparently is to be enjoyed apart from red meat, obviously, with things that have a funky flavor, something like blue cheese, for instance. Oh. I'd still very much go, if you have a Malbec, have some red meat with it.
Are you saying we blue cheese at the moment?
We're very much in that territory, aren't we?
Yeah. Anyway, but guys, I think that's it for us this week. You can maybe tune in again next week. We're going to have a good review of the Springboks performance and what they're going to encounter in Argentina next week when they leave there as well. And how are we looking for the World Cup?
And also next week, it's last chance saloon for those guys who hope to, catch the attention of the coaches and the selectors.
Thanks for listening. And a reminder, you can find all the To The Last Drop podcasts on the Brendan Nell YouTube channel, iono.fm, Spotify, player.fm, Pocket Casts, Google Podcasts, and iTunes, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.